Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
You may be the first president in history to go down because you can't stop inappropriately talking about an investigation.
Is that policy in writing somewhere?
I think so.
I took it as a direction. I mean, this is the president of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do.
Hello and welcome to Drumcast, the show about the man who says the health care bill passed by House Republicans is mean. Last month, he called it a great plan. He's Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Today on the show, Trump as a brand. People sometimes think about Donald Trump as having three biographical phases: businessman, then reality TV star, then politician. But really, there's no difference in the way Trump has approached these roles. He's the same guy doing the same stuff to sell himself in the same way, through spectacle, glitz, and massive distraction. The Donald Trump of Atlantic City, the Donald Trump of The Apprentice, and the Donald Trump of Pennsylvania Avenue are all engaged in the same enterprise and the same performance with the same goal: the goal of making the Trump name into a super valuable super brand. My guest today says that that kind of hollowed out, not actually making anything company that Trump represents isn't unusual. It's the epitome of how businesses want to present themselves in the global economy. I'll be back with the writer Naomi Klein to talk about her new book right after we do the tweets.
After 7 months of investigations and committee hearings about my collusion with Russians, nobody has been able to show any proof, said. The fake news media hates when I use what has turned out to be my very powerful social media. Over 100 million people. I can go around them. Despite the phony witch hunt going on in America, the economic and job numbers are great. Regulations way down, jobs and enthusiasm way up. The new Rasmussen poll, one of the most accurate in the 2016 election, just out, with a Trump 50% approval rating. That's higher than O's numbers. I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director. Witch hunt.
This episode is made possible by PwC. It's getting hot out here. Moving the mercury can help move your business. PwC helps turn sustainability theory into real-world action. Reduce your carbon footprint while increasing transparency in net zero commitments. Start with reporting to identify your climate risks and reinvent your business. Create a more sustainable business and a stronger planet. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at thenewequation.com.
I'm joined in the studio today by the writer Naomi Klein. Her new book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you.
So I thought your book was really insightful, interesting for a bunch of reasons. One thing I liked about it was that you don't focus on analyzing Trump psychologically. You don't really focus on the question of what's wrong with this guy. You look at him in cultural terms and economic terms. And I thought it was interesting. It looked like you went back and actually watched a lot of his reality TV show, Celebrity Apprentice.
Original Apprentice, yeah.
And the Original Apprentice.
Yeah.
What did you learn watching that?
So the first part of the book is looking at Trump as a super brand, because I think it is really significant that there is the first fully commercialized super brand as a U.S. president. And I think in terms of understanding the web of conflicts of interest and also his relationship with his base, why it is so hard to hold him accountable for anything, you really need to understand what it means to be a super brand. And so for Trump, that is all about The Apprentice, right? Because before The Apprentice, he was much more of a traditional businessman, in the sense that he was about building buildings, buying buildings, and he just happened to really like to slap his name on those buildings in, you know, big letters. And he happened to have this tremendous gift for self-promotion. I suppose, you know, gift may not be the right word, but, you know, he knew, has always known how to work the press, as you guys know in New York very, very well, right? He had, long before reality television, he turned his personal life into a live action soap opera, right? So he understood the value of the show. But through the 80s and 90s, he was still a traditional company. And by traditional company, I mean a company that was about selling the product, a product, not a brand first.
Building buildings. I mean, digging holes in the ground and constructing things and selling them.
Right. Yeah. But in this period, you saw the emergence of hollow brands. I called them in my first book, No Logo, where there was this, the order flipped, right? The traditional role of branding was you had manufacturing-based companies that made a product, they branded that product. They slapped a friendly figure like Uncle Ben or Aunt Jemima on their product to differentiate it, and they poured money into marketing so that you would pay a premium for their branded product. But they were still product-based companies. The shift happened really in the 90s when you had companies like Nike announcing, actually, we are a marketing company first. We are selling an idea first. And we are extending that idea into this kind of branded cocoon, right? But because our primary labor is the labor of finding that core idea, connecting with consumers, we don't need to produce our own products at all. Other people can do that. So this is intimately connected with the fact that it became a lot easier in this era, thanks to free trade, to produce your products through a web of contractors and subcontractors. So Trump didn't become that kind of company until The Apprentice. The Apprentice gave him this opportunity to have this long commercial for his brand, where he was actually paid, right? I mean, this was branding gold, where he was paid to have endless commercials for the meaning of his brand. And the meaning of his brand has always been power through wealth, absolute power through wealth. I would argue even impunity through wealth. If you're rich enough, you're living the absolute dream, right? And you can do whatever you want to whoever you want. And so the long, loving shots of his helicopters and private jets and, all of his many homes, all of this reinforced the dream of Trump. But yeah, going back and watching The Apprentice is really interesting, because I refer to it as sort of televised class warfare, because, you start with these images of a homeless guy sleeping on the streets of New York and then pan to Trump. And it's very clearly, we live in this world of losers and winners, big losers and big winners. So this is tapping into the inequality that, was at the center of Bernie Sanders' campaign. But whereas Bernie Sanders is saying, let's fix it, Trump is saying, no, my promise is I'm going to make you a winner in this world where not being a winner is so very dangerous.
So you've already introduced an interesting question, which is whether taking this into politics is a cynical exercise in hands to increase his brand value, which I think he talked about explicitly when he ran for president at an earlier time. And clearly, he hasn't divested from his business. I mean, he's making a lot of money.
He's expanding his business. Yeah.
He's using the presidency to make money. So he's clearly doing that. But there's an interesting question about whether he's doing that cynically and that's the goal of being president. It's why he wants to be president. Or is this a man who just thinks this way about branding and appearance and creating this bifurcation around success and failure? Does he think he's doing that for the country for real, or is he just having a laugh at the expense of his followers?
Well, you know, as you say, I don't engage in too much Trump psychologizing. I just feel like that's a hole I'll never get out of. But, you know, one thing that I think is fair to say is that Trump has been doing this for so long that he does not know where his personal brand, where the commercial brand Trump ends and where some notion of there being a non-commercial Trump brand ends. Like, I think he cannot separate these things. And his children, who have grown up entirely within the cocoon of the Trump brand, you know, I say in the book that he breeds brands, and I think that's fair enough. You know,
they have their own baby brands. Yes.
Yeah. And the way he brought his kids into The Apprentice, even the way he brought Ivanka into, you know, Miss Teen Universe at a very young age, you know, they've always been brand extensions as well, maybe first, right? And the extent to which they appear to be his favorites, and he clearly has favorites in his family, is, you know, the extent to which they're successful brands. So I can't answer that question, and I'm not sure it's answerable, because the whole idea, and this is where I think there's been a failure to really reckon with how new this is. I mean, the whole idea of having a global empire built around an actual human being, right, is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, even the whole brand, like the hollow-based company whose business model is to sell its name to other companies to do the work, right? Because since The Apprentice, Trump, you know, still has a couple of flagship properties like Trump Tower in New York and Mar-a-Lago, but the vast majority of his money comes from selling his
brand
name.
Brand licensing, as you
yeah.
say.
Yeah. And not just for the ties and the suits and the water and the steaks and all of that, but for the Trump Towers around the world and resorts around the Trump resorts around the world. So this is a new business model. It creates a huge new opportunities for conflicts of interest. But just like there are Trump avatars out there selling Trump products, you know, as we speak, and as he's saying, he's separated from his business. It's a house of mirrors. You know, Ivanka, who has also said she's separated from her business, there are avatars of Ivanka selling Trump condominiums in Manila. You know, they can't separate because they built companies around themselves.
Right. The name is being sold and the profits are going to them. And that's a question. We've talked about those conflicts of interest a lot on the show. And it is a question I've raised of how could you even separate yourself from such a business, because without the name, there's no business.
Right. And this is where, you know, I think that the lawsuits that have emerged now, I mean, when I wrote the book, there was a lawsuit that I think was less of a threat to Trump around whether or not he's violating the Constitution. And it was, I think, a Washington hotel restaurant, a restaurant workers union taking him to court. But now you have 190 congresspeople who are alleging that he's in violation of the emolument clause that says that he can't be receiving gifts from foreign governments. And that's a very big deal, because the Constitution actually says is he can't do this without permission from Congress. So the actual actors in this are now involved, right? They're saying we should have been consulted. And it'll be really interesting to see what comes out of that lawsuit in terms of unpacking some of this, because a lot so far Trump has focused on his spokespeople have focused on just the hotel room side of it. And I actually think that's probably the weakest piece of the legal case, because you can easily, you know, make the argument that, okay, so maybe they're favoring these Trump hotels, but, you know, the rate they're not paying extra, or, you know, that business was happening anyway. But then, you know, you look at something like the fact that the Chinese government has detained labor watchdogs who were blowing the whistle on abusive labor conditions in factories making Ivanka branded goods. They very well may think that this is a good way, this is a gift to the Trump family.
To ingratiate themselves, like making sure he gets all these patents, which Ivanka's been getting too.
Yeah.
But it suggests an interesting strategy. And I mean, if the essence of Trump is the brand and the brand is what he cares about, hit him where he lives. Right. He doesn't care what you say about his policies. I mean, this is a guy who attacked the health care bill he supported 2 weeks ago as cruel. He can say anything about policy. He can pivot 180 degrees. But if you figure out a way to attack his brand, reduce the value of the brand, he really suffers. It may or may not lead to impeachment, but it's something he cares about.
He definitely cares. And that's why it's important to understand what it is that he's selling, that he's selling this fantasy of being of absolute power, of being the boss that can get away with anything. That's the promise at the heart of his project. That's why he said on the campaign trail, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. So every time Trump gets away with something else, it doesn't hurt his brand. It reinforces his brand. He's following the formula of good branding, which is stay true to your brand. But on the other hand, he clearly is deeply bothered by, you know, parodies like President Bannon and any suggestion that he is a puppet of anyone, whether that puppet is Putin or Pence or whoever, because that hurts his brand. But I think there are limits to the strategy. And I do think he is vulnerable on policy. I don't agree that he's not vulnerable at all on policy, because there is this other brand, and that brand is Make America Great Again, yeah. is MAGA. There were promises that were made related to that brand that were very resonant to workers in this country. I'm going to bring the jobs back. I'm going to stand up for you. I'm going to drain the swamp. And one of the things that really worries me is that Trump, the showman, is so good at the art of distraction. And this is something he has understood since he started putting on the Trump show. I mean, I quote in the book that this 1980s interview with Playboy where he says the show is Trump and it's sold out everywhere, right? That's still true.
Yeah.
And so long as we are focused on the Trump show, and I would make a distinction that Trump is the executive producer of part of the Trump show, but not all of the Trump show. I mean, I don't think he wants the Russia investigation going on. I think that's pretty clear. But that constant drama and really this reality show that's unfolding in Washington right now seems to be sucking up about 80 or 90% of the media attention, and at the expense of a really systematic look every day, with a lot of attention at how he is breaking the promises at the heart of that MAGA brand. You know, he might not care if he's changing his position from week to week, but I would argue that there's a substantial number of voters that do care. And I think there's vulnerability there, but it's not being exploited because the Trump show continues to be so seductive. And this is the dynamic that elected Trump, the addiction to the Trump show, and it's intimately connected to ratings.
So let's talk about the media for a minute and then about the opposition. Now, I know you've been here all week. You've been reading the American press. You usually live in Toronto, right? But how good or bad a job do you think the media is doing? It's the specific thing you talked about, keeping the focus on performance around some particular fight about jobs is, of course, close to impossible because of the tsunami of news we get every day at 6 o'clock. And there are literally hundreds of outrages around the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And so maintaining the focus on any one of them is almost an impossibility. So if that's the standard, I don't know how you can do it. But what's your take, having been sort of absorbed in the press here for a little bit at least?
Well, I do think it's a little worrying that well before Trump, we had politicians who were increasingly using the best tools of branding to sell an image to the public, which often was not backed up by policies that were in keeping with that brand. Obama was a master marketer, a master brander. He was not a commercialized brand as a president in the way Trump is by any means. But we're seeing this from politicians now. As you mentioned, I live in Canada. We've got an incredible brand as a PM. You know, Justin Trudeau knows how to do this from the progressive side. And, you know, I actually think it's quite dangerous what goes on with these liberal politicians who are really great at selling progressive ideas and putting out progressive memes and symbols and raising hopes and not backing them up nearly enough with policies, and the way that creates a context for right-wing populism to enter in and into the gap between the promise and the reality. So there were these mea culpas of how the media helped set the table for Trump in creating election coverage that was so much like reality TV. And then along comes a reality TV show star and says, well, you guys are jokers. I actually know how to do this, you know? I understand that it's a very difficult situation. I mean, when you have all day testimony, you know, on Capitol Hill from Jeff Sessions, you have to cover it, you know? You have to cover it when Comey is testifying. But we have to be aware that Mitch McConnell has never had it so good. Like, and believe me, I think he did not design this. I think the Republicans have just stumbled into an absolutely perfect strategy for getting an extremely radical economic agenda that is redistributing wealth upwards on every front. And they're doing it with almost no attention. I mean, all eyes on Comey, and meanwhile, they're dismantling Dodd-Frank. You know, all eyes on Sessions, and meanwhile, the Senate is negotiating healthcare in the dark, and there's almost no coverage for it, right? So this is working really, really well for that economic project, and I think the problem with going all in with this idea that this is going to lead to impeachment is, of course, it's not going to lead to impeachment so long as the Republicans are in power, and they're not going to throw Trump under the bus so long as he's holding on to his base, and he's going to hold on to his base until there is some focus on the economic betrayals.
Yeah. I mean, but you talk about this Republican project, but doesn't that cover over a split in the party between, you know, the people who are libertarians, government minimalists, people who want government out of everything, everything left to the free market, you know, what you call neoliberalism, on the one hand, and the sort of Trump view of the world on the other hand, which is much more corporatist, government intervening in the marketplace in all sorts of ways, populist and nationalist. But Trump is not Milton Friedman. I mean, to the extent Trump has a philosophy, it's very, very different kind of Republican politics from that libertarian free market view of the world.
Well, if we look at what he's actually done with economic policy, I would argue it's pretty much in keeping, right? I mean, you're absolutely right. That's what he ran on, right? And there's no doubt that his willingness to mix in this hyper anti-globalist position and trying to get at the sort of Breitbart comment section that is just suspicious of anything international, global, foreign, you know, whether it is immigrants, the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, I mean, all of it is just like, this just this incredibly sort of xenophobic response to the world that is new in the willingness to go that far, right? I mean, there's always been elements of it within the Republican Party. But if we look at the economic policies that he's actually introducing, he's outsourced it to the Heritage Foundation and Goldman Sachs. I mean, this is, what is he doing on the economic front that lives up to what you're describing, right? His infrastructure plan turns out to actually be a privatization plan, right? What he's doing with NAFTA, if you listen to his commerce secretary, is deepening the agenda that he ran against. He's literally reassuring business audiences that they're going to make it more like the best practices in the TPP. So Trump did an incredible bait and switch on economics. What he ended up doing, I think, is going much further down that road. There's definitely a gap. And what he understands is that he couldn't run on that, and Bannon understands it. But this is why I think they're vulnerable on it, because it is, you know, it turns out to have been such a lie.
They're not delivering on any of those economic policies. Well, I think, though, he could swing back the other direction tomorrow, including attacking his own cabinet if it served him, and it might at some point.
Well, I think he's doing something so far pretty sly, right, where he knows he needs to feed some things to that anti-globalist base, right? So he feeds them dropping out of the Paris Accord, right? Which is not, you know, even though there may be many U.S. corporations that would rather have the U.S. stay in the Paris Accord, it's not really nearly so troubling as it would be if he were serious about what he was saying about free trade. And so on the one hand, it's sort of the cheapest possible positions to satisfy that arm of his coalition. He's making those offers. Meanwhile, the things that would actually seriously be a threat to wealth and power in this country, he's going in the opposite direction, and he's hoping they won't notice. And they may well not notice if there isn't the kind of coverage that's necessary and if there aren't real alternatives. But it is, you know, it's also interesting that you know, we're seeing more talk about single-payer healthcare. You know, I think that's the kind of direction that there needs to be, where there's a sort of a real alternative that people might get excited about.
So let's talk about the opposition a little bit. I mean, with Trump in power, you and I agree. With Trump out of power, you and I probably don't agree about a lot of things. I'm much more of a center liberal. Mm-hmm. I don't have big issues with Obama's politics or Trudeau's politics. I understand your critique and find it very interesting. But how do we avoid a super divisive fight on the American left between Sanders people and Clinton people? I mean, the split we had, but which was in a way just a taste of things to come, because Trump, to people who agree with you, Trump makes an even stronger argument that Sanders politics is what should be offered in opposition. And probably to people like me, it makes a case for let's reclaim the center of the American electorate. That's how we win an election. And not to mention the
policies. But it isn't how you won. That is the campaign that Hillary won.
But, you know, in normal times, Trump doesn't win that election. The Clinton liberal who's not Hillary Clinton wins that election.
Well, I don't think we're in normal times, and I don't think we've been in normal times for a long time. And the sort of ground that you're describing, the sort of neoliberal center, you know, is collapsing around the world. And
when you say neoliberal, I mean, that's the term that always sort of bothers me. I mean, I my first job was at the Washington Monthly, which had an older definition of neoliberal, which we would probably call progressive now, very pro-government, pro-interventionist, but very practically minded. But neoliberal has become this term for people who believe in no government, you know, who believe in the market solutions to everything. That I don't think that describes the politics. Maybe there are some Wall Street Democrats who would answer to that description, but I don't think it describes Hillary Clinton's politics. Do you see her as a neoliberal?
Yes, I do. Which isn't to say that she ran as a neoliberal fully, but I think what hurt her is she had a long track record and was therefore not a credible messenger. She ended up running against the TPP. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, if you help negotiate it, people are a little smart enough to not see that as credible. And she was vulnerable on that. I see this fantasy emerging now that there could be like some sort of blank slate neoliberal, like a Macron type character who didn't have any baggage. I frankly think it's dangerous. I think it's dangerous, you know, looking at what's happening in France right now, which is a few years behind the U.S. in its adoption of these economic policies. I mean, France held out for longer and had a much more mixed economy than the U.S. did and than the U.K. did. And I don't find it reassuring that Marine Le Pen got, you know, around, what, 30%. Of the vote in France. And I'm very worried that Macron is going to govern in a way that will position the far racist right in France to surge next time. And so, and it's because these policies really are failing. And I think there is a vacuum. And, you know, I think it's interesting what just happened in the UK, where what really turned it around for Corbyn, and, you know, he didn't win, but he did better than, you know, anybody expected. And it's certainly significant that the Tories lost their majority. What turned it around for him was coming out with a manifesto that held out genuine hope that they could improve lives. And it was a deeply anti-neoliberal platform. I mean, it was reversing privatizations of the rail system, massive investments in the public healthcare system, which has been cut and cut and cut. The campaign put public sector workers, particularly healthcare workers, at the center of the campaign, made them the stars of the campaign, telling the human stories of austerity, campaigning to get rid of tuition fees. This is what galvanized people. And what I believe is that when we are in this time of a surging neo-fascist right around the world, that the only way to counter that is with left-wing economic populism. You know, but obviously we disagree on this. But, you know, I'm passionate about it.
If you're left and my left fight it out, that doesn't bode very well for the results in the midterms or in the next presidential election. I mean, maybe we'll be fine, but it's
some debate is healthy because the stakes are incredibly high, you know. And I don't believe that the way the debate is playing out right now is particularly healthy, but I think there has to be a way to talk to each other. You know, the bubbles are not just the sort of Trump bubble and the Democrat bubble. There are also bubbles between the sort of center liberals and the Bernie left, where there's very few places to talk to each other, where it's not just screaming on Twitter. There aren't many conversations like the one we're having. And I think that's really too bad.
I've been speaking to the writer Naomi Klein. Her new book is No Is Not Enough. Naomi, thanks for joining me on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
That's it for today's show. But before we go, I have a recommendation for you. Have you checked out I Have to Ask yet? It's a podcast hosted by Isaac Chotiner, our resident interviewer here at Slate. It's an excellent show. His past guests have included Congressman Tom Cole, that was a really good interview, and the writer at New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait. You can find all the episodes of I Have to Ask at slate.com/ask. That's slate.com/ask. And please make sure you're following us on Twitter. That's where you can keep up with all the latest from the TrumpCast team. We're at Real TrumpCast. That's at Real TrumpCast. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.